the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
First with Nadina Galle, a 2024 National Geographic Explorer and Ecological Engineer, who discusses the nature of our cities, harnessing the power of the natural world to survive a changing planet.
Then we have a conversation with biologist Daniel Brooks and Salvatore Augusta about the hope for humanity's survival. But we will need to act with the rest of the biosphere and with each other in accordance with Darwin's principles of survival.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
We live in an age when humanity spends 90% of its time indoors, yet the nature around us, especially in America's cities, has never been more vital. This distancing from nature has sparked crises in mental health, longevity, and hope for the next generation. It's also heightened the risks we face from historic floods, heat waves, and wildfires. But what if the innovation and power of technology were harnessed to create nature-rich communities? Our next guest is ecological engineer Nadina Galle, who also is a fellow at MIT's Sensible City Lab and is a 2024 National Geographic Explorer. She coined this concept called the Internet of Nature, and it's all about the ways we can utilize technology to create nature-rich communities. And it's all in her new book, which we'll discuss with her today, The Nature of Our Cities. Nadina Galle, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Lynn and Katie.
First of all, how do you describe, what's your acronym for Internet of Nature?
ION.
ION. You know, this is a concept that we talk a lot about in this whole sensible city and smart city concept. But there, when you looked at smart cities, there was something that came up short for you. What is the concept of a smart city and what came up short?
Yeah, the smart city, I think it's becoming more and more ubiquitous, you know, even for the general audience, the general population to have come across this idea of a smart city, which really at its core is the use of new and emerging technologies to improve urban life and improve quality of life for the people that live there. So that can take many different forms. Using technology to take to improve democratic processes like voting, for example, but it can also include things like the way we light our cities or the way we move around our cities or the way we optimize traffic or parking, all of these different assets of urban life. But what really struck me as I was looking into that topic for my PhD research at the time is that it really lacked any really even recognition of the fact that our cities are built on natural ecosystems. And none of these new and exciting and emerging technologies were being used to preserve and protect the natural ecosystems on which our cities are built. And that frustrated me.
I was just over the weekend in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. I walked 10 miles in the park itself. And as I was doing it, I thought, what would this city be like if it didn't have this incredible park? And what foresight there was to reserve this in perpetuity and the importance of parks like this, whether it's a big, you know, central park like that or little pocket parks throughout cities. Can you just talk about the importance of that and why people actually did have that foresight a long time ago?
Yeah, I mean, we really saw the first introduction of urban parks as we know them today in the late 1800s as the Industrial Revolution was marching on and more people lived to cities for better, moved to cities for better economic opportunities. Urban parks were seen as a way to bring the beautiful serenity of the countryside into urban life. And that's why we see beautiful old, I mean, Golden Gate Park, Hyde Park in London, Vondel Park in Amsterdam, Central Park, the Emerald Necklace in Boston. These are all early examples of that kind of foresight that you talk about, Lynn. And The crazy thing, though, is as we've moved now 100 years on, is that these urban parks, which were once meant for just one thing, that was really to offer respite to urban citizens, serenity to urban citizens, a place to get away from it all. And one could argue that they still very much hold that role. But now, as I like to call it, they have to, our urban parks and our natural spaces have to fulfill a whole laundry list of other duties, quote unquote. They have to provide the buffer for extreme weather events, whether that be heat waves or flooding or hurricanes, heavy windfalls. The nature in our cities provides a resilient buffer to that. But at the same time, it also, as urban life has become more hectic and more stressful and more having a more negative impact on our health, we turn to these natural spaces as a way to get respite from that as well. So urban parks are doing, there's more and more pressure on them with the pressures of urban development, yet we need them to do so much more for us, even much more than they did 100 years ago.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Nadina Galley. She is an ecological engineer and author of the new book, The Nature of Our Cities, Harnessing the Power of the Natural World to Survive a Changing Planet. Well, you know, as we were talking before the show started, as we live in this beautiful mountain town, everywhere we look is nature, but it's so easy for all of us, even though I'm 15 feet from a pine tree, it's so easy for me to be in my house, walk to my car, get in my car, walk to an office, I mean, and not intentionally get into nature, even when we are immersed in it. Why is it so important for us to actually take the time to be outside, I mean, versus the 90% of our time inside?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I talk about this in the book. It's not enough just to live in a nature-rich community. We also need to be spending time in that nature-rich community. And that's really for two reasons. Number one, I wholeheartedly believe that we cannot possibly care for or understand and protect the places that we do not use. You know, if you don't use it, you lose it kind of idea. So if we want to see the value of these places and protect and preserve them, we need to be using them as such as well. But the second part is it is so supremely important to get outside and enjoy the benefits of nature. I mean, I go into some of the, what has really become almost reductionistic benefits of spending time outside. It's so easy for us to take kind of that scientific perspective and really kind of boil down, well, you know, being outside is great for your vitamin D. It's great for your eyesight. It's great for your cognitive development. It's great for being able to relieve your anxiety disorders and feel less depressed. But you can kind of boil it down into all those little miniature statistics. And there's tons and tons of research coming out to show what that is. But I think we need to see it as the full picture. We as human beings have done a complete shift. Ancient humans spent 90% of their time outdoors and 10% of their time indoors and in a cave, if you will, if you can even call that indoors. And now that's completely shifted, where we're having this 93% of our time we spend indoors. Like, we are losing the essence of what it means to be human beings. And I truly believe that if we spent more time outside and all of the health benefits, both physical and mental, that came from that, I think we would be a happier, healthier population overall.
Well,
and more productive.
Exactly. I know. I feel much better after a nice little walk in nature. Well, so much of our population is moving into the cities, and these cities are becoming more and more concrete jungles, if you will. How can people today in an urban environment actually connect with nature? Because it seems like there's less and less green space. So how is the average person walking down New York City connect with nature? I mean, they're outside, but does that really count if you're on a sidewalk surrounded by buildings?
Yeah, absolutely. And I talk about this. I think there's different ways to use technology to facilitate these first interactions. I kind of relate it like a dating app, right? You might meet that, you might have that first interaction online, but it's really up to you to then take that relationship offline and in real life, if you will, as quickly as possible and develop it in real life from there on. So I see technology as it's never a replacement for technology or for it's technology is never a replacement for nature, but it absolutely can offer that first kind of facilitation and interaction. So I talk about a couple of different examples in the book, because first of all, if you live in, especially if you live in a new place and you don't know where nature is around you, you got to find it. So AllTrails is a fantastic app. It actually won App of the Year in 2023, which I thought was so incredible. It was such a testament to the importance of people's understanding of how important it is to get outside and get in nature by the general population. So it's an app that just shows you all the different trails and opportunities around you. And what I love about it is like all of the trails that are on there are user tested. It gives great, as we talked about our earlier point, ideas of accessibility, both for wheelchairs and for strollers and other forms of accessibility. Another great app is Nature Dose, which actually it's like a personalized nature prescription tracker. So it actually aggregates how much time, not only that you were in outside, but how much time of that time outside you're actually exposed to nature. So it gives you that little nudge in the same way that a Fitbit might remind you, hey, you've only, you know, hit 500 steps today. You might consider doing that. It's really this recognition that it's not how many steps you get, but also where you take those steps that matter. And then there's another wonderful initiative that I'll quickly mention called City Nature Challenge, which is organized by the California Academy of Sciences and the National History Museum of Los Angeles County. Every single year at the end of April, beginning of May, there's this 4-day bio blitz, which is organized, where this past year, 700 cities took part. San Antonio, Texas actually got runner-up second place. La Paz, not the capital, but the biggest city in Bolivia, won first place. It's this invitation to observe and identify and photograph as many different flora and fauna species in your surroundings and upload those to iNaturalist. And it's just another way to get people outside that don't normally think to do so and open up the wonderful world that the natural spaces have to offer us.
Oh, these are wonderful suggestions. The first app that you mentioned after All Trails, and we use All Trails a lot in our town between All Trails and Trail Forks. Those are very popular apps, but the one that just sort of gives you the aggregate of how much time you've spent outside making meaningful connections. What was that one?
Nature Dose.
Nature Dose. That is wonderful. And then another thing that I've been using recently is it's amazing that it just on our iPhones, that you can take a picture of a plant, and it's just within your photo app that it will identify that plant for you, which connects you again to nature, right? These things, absolutely, these exposures, again, it's that combination of technology and nature. In your book, you talk a lot about quite a few different innovators and what they are doing around the world. Can you highlight one of those?
Well, one of them I'm really passionate about is a man named Anukul Lakhaina. And he co-founded a company called BurnBot. And this is we've talked about ways to get urbanites, you know, out in nature. I talk a lot in the book about some of the different big urban issues that we're facing, whether that be heat waves or flooding or wildfires. And Anukul is featured in the wildfires chapter. And he was really inspired by what is really indigenous wisdom, this practice of doing prescribed burning. So basically pre-burning a landscape so that if and when a catastrophic wildfire were to come through, it's basically stopped in its tracks. The problem with prescribed burning is that there's a very, very limited season that you can do it in, because you don't want to do it when it's too dry, because the chance of the prescribed burn escaping is too great. And you also can't do it when it's too wet, because nothing will burn. He developed, together with his team, something called BurnBot. And it is essentially what it sounds like. It is a firefighting robot. So it's powered by artificial intelligence. And essentially what it does is creates these burn lines, and it produces about 95% less smoke than a prescribed burn would. Because if you can imagine doing a prescribed burn in a wildfire, previously affected wildfire community, just the smell of smoke is enough to send people into a panic attack. So they've been able to develop this technology, be able to do prescribed burns, you know, cover like thousands of acres, you know, rather than just a few that, you know, a hands-on team would be able to do, and be able to do it in a way that produces so much less smoke, because the USDA Forest Service is really struggling to do enough prescribed burns as they said that they would, because they simply just do not have the resources and manpower. And this is a way that I feel technology can really, really benefit this massive and growing problem of wildfires.
I'm wondering if you could explain that a little bit more, how you decrease the smoke from, how this bot decreases smoke from these burns. It's incredible.
So essentially how it works is it does the burning in a completely separated and isolated unit. So the smoke that is created is immediately put into that unit and filtered out. And it does this in a way so that you see a little bit of smoke kind of dissipate from the sides. But I think the best way to explain just how little smoke it produces is that Anigul and his co-founder actually used the burn bot in his highly dense San Jose neighborhood outside of San Francisco, and none of his neighbors noticed it at work.
Well, we were talking earlier about the Internet of Nature, but one of the things I just love the term Wood Wide Web. And you say that's the existing interconnection of nature. You know, we've talked with fungi experts on this show about just the interconnected nature of fungi itself. But underneath a city, what sort of interconnected nature is there? What sort of Wood Wide Web exists below a big city?
I'm so glad you asked, Katie, because this was actually the subject of my PhD research, which was trying to understand how we can actually use both sensors and satellite imagery and other emerging technologies to figure out what are the mycorrhizal associations. So what is the presence of the Wood Wide Web in urban trees? So I did this research with red maple trees in Cambridge and Boston, Massachusetts. And my findings were is that none of the trees that were planted in single isolated tree pits, as we tend to see most street trees be planted in, had enough mycorrhizal association. So you can actually call these trees lonely trees. They're completely on their own. They don't have the support network of their fellow trees. And that was completely different, as you might expect, in natural spaces and in parkland, where trees do have the opportunity to be connected with one another. That doesn't mean just because the tree doesn't have mycorrhizal association doesn't mean it can't survive, but it's definitely having a hard time thriving. And I think that's the case for many city trees in cities around the world. There are these isolated beings. And again, we expect so much of them. We expect them to be our air conditioners, what filters our stormwater, that beautify our streets, that give us shade, that provide us cooling. So we expect so much of these individual trees. So the best way that we can give our thanks, if you will, is to take as best care of them as we can.
Well, speaking of trees, you talk about a company called Overstory, and they're using imaging and AI to help with power line conflicts. One, I love the name. And tell us more about this company, because that sounds essential, because it was correlated directly with the Maui fires.
Yes, absolutely. Overstory is a Dutch company founded in Amsterdam. And I'm Dutch originally, and I've been living in Amsterdam for the past 10 years. And I was able to meet them when they were just starting up. We were kind of, as I explained in my PhD research, doing a lot with satellite imagery and with trees. So we kind of met each other through that. It's been incredible to watch them grow. They're now becoming one of the leading vegetation monitoring companies, specifically for utilities. So a lot of people might not know is that it's actually the utility company's responsibility to clear what they call the right of way, this area that runs along power lines. And this is very different to the Dutch situation. In the Netherlands, the majority of our power lines are underneath the ground, but this is not the case in the US and also not the case in Canada, where I grew up. And this means is that it's very, very easy for vegetation and power lines to come in conflict with each other. Actually, it is one of the leading causes of wildfires, that when it gets dry and scorching hot conditions, and you know there can be sparks flying, it just takes one spark to fall on a dry brush or have it be in contact with the power line to ignite a catastrophic wildfire. This is what caused the catastrophic wildfire in Paradise, California, known as the Camp Fire in 2018. And it was also what is now known to be the cause of the Maui wildfire in Lahaina. What Overstory does is it uses high resolution satellite imagery so based on the satellite, these orbit very frequently, which means that we have monthly, if not biannual imagery, to be able to target and show exactly where vegetation is coming into contact with power lines, so that the utility company knows this is where we need to target our right-of-way clearing. Because as you can imagine, if you are responsible for millions of acres, how can you possibly know where to start? Doing it by drones or even helicopters is simply not cutting it, as we've seen. But it goes even further than that, because what Overstory has shown is that certain tree species can actually be fire resistant. So there are certain tree species that you actually do want in the right of way, because they can provide these really important wildfire buffers. So they're also doing species identification to show where these fire resistant trees are and how we might be able to better manage those as well. So it's not just about this is where you should clear vegetation, it's also about this is the vegetation you should keep, which I think is quite beautiful.
That's wonderful. You know, here in our town in Park City, we have aspen trees. That's probably the number, like the highest number of trees that we have are aspens. And they are known to be, I don't know if they're fire resistant, but they have a lot of water in them. Is that, do aspens come on your radar at all?
Not particularly that I've come across. But I mean, but that's it. Like when I say fire resistant trees, they are the trees that indeed hold a lot of water and simply don't burn up in the way that other trees do.
So this is all tied in also to one of the innovators that you talk about, Matthew Wells from the city of Santa Monica. You talk about how, and I have this question as well. So on the one hand, we need defensible space. So we need to get our trees away from our homes. And maybe this was something that he did. He was trying to protect the city's trees, but then through satellite imagery, he saw how dangerous the number of trees or where they were located. It's kind of a contradiction to want to bring the trees away from our house, but still preserve the trees because so many homes are built with trees much too close to them. You know, coming up with a way to include trees, but not have them eventually threaten us.
Absolutely. And this is where I feel technology can play such an important role because we simply have, and I talk about this story of the chief urban forester of Boston, and I walk into his office and it's covered in post-it notes. He's got scribbles on his hands and he is taking care of Boston's, you know, hundreds of thousands of trees on public land. And he's simply doing it all in his brain and on post-it notes. We are the parks and recreation departments of our cities are so lagging behind in technological advances to be able to manage what I would argue is one of our most critical infrastructural assets. We would never, ever, ever accept this kind of management for bridges, power lines, infrastructure, our mobility, our waste management. Yet we've kind of accepted it for the management of our green infrastructure and our trees. And we simply cannot even be able to understand how complex this resource is because trees and natural spaces, they're totally different than bridges and buildings and mobility. They're a living, breathing organisms. They're changing all the time. They're growing all the time. And like you say, Lynn, they can also become risks to people. And one of the most, I think, inspiring stories in the book is the story of Singapore, who just in the year 2000 was really under having massive issues with its population because they were having a ton of what they call people tree incidents. Meaning some kind of conflict, whether that's a branch falling on your car or a branch falling on a person or a tree falling over and becoming a danger. They had so many tree incidents that they were really, really facing a PR crisis for trees, if you will. And what they did is they made use of a bunch of different emerging technologies, whether that be tree sensors, tilt sensors, which show how much the wind is impacting different trees, moisture sensors. And something that I think is going to be the future of urban forestry is terrestrial LIDAR, which is simply creating a 3D model of all of the trees that a city offers and being able to use that data set that you can update if you want it on a weekly basis, monthly basis, something we'd never, ever, ever be able to do just with simple human power on the street. And offering this real-time model of what's happening with the trees so that we can actually make sure that people are safe and enjoying the benefits of trees and that our climate resilience depends on them without putting people at unnecessary risk.
Well, one final question before we let you go today. You know, we are in Park City, Utah, but we do have a number of listeners around the globe because so many people chime in online. How can our listeners, especially the ones in urban environments, start to bring more nature into their lives, into their neighborhoods, into their communities, you know, basically starting today?
Yeah, it's a great question. The one thing I would say is first discover what's around you and make more use of that, right? Instead of meeting your friend for a coffee or going out for dinner or what have you, say, hey, have you had your nature dose today? And take that person with, take your family out, take your friends out, take your colleagues out. It's such a great way to have meetings also for the professionals out there and take them out in nature and be able to develop a habit where you're used to getting outside every single day, taking advantage of what you have. And then once you have a better sense of what's out there, see if there are actions that you can take to preserve those spaces, whether that's getting involved in a volunteer group, whether that's involved in a tree planting, or more importantly, a tree maintenance effort. Maybe getting out there and seeing how you might be able to start a community garden, seeing what you can do in your own private land, in your backyard or in your foreground or even in your balcony. There are ways, even if you don't own land yourself, that we can contribute to the greening of our cities. And it's more important than ever.
I love that idea. The nature of our cities, harnessing the power of the natural world to survive a changing planet. And our guest is ecological engineer Nadina Galley. She is also a Forbes 30 under 30 person and a 2024 National Geographic Explorer. You are unusual among the National Geographic Explorers we've spoken to, Nadina. And it's for this work here. Can you just briefly tell us about it before we let you go?
Yeah, it was a huge honor to be named a NatGeo Explorer, mostly because I think it speaks volumes about where this movement is going, that we are, you know, NatGeo Explorers are known for exploring, you know, the furthest regions of our planet. And I got to do a lot of that throughout my studies. But the more that I specialized, the more fascinated I became, not with faraway nature, but by the nature at our doorstep. And I think it's such a beautiful recognition that nature matters, that nature, even in its smallest forms, especially because it's the nature that we have daily interactions with, matters, and we need to preserve it and we need to understand it better. And I'm thrilled to be able to do that under the title and for National Geographic.
Well, a huge congratulations to you for that honor. Nadina, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
As a species, humanity faces existential threats from all directions: overpopulation, global climate change, and urbanization, just to name a few. But according to our next guest, there are novel and even hopeful ways to meet these challenges. But we must change the conversation from sustainability to survival. It begins with humans starting to act with the rest of the biosphere and with each other in accordance with Darwinian principles that center around figuring out how to survive. Joining us to share hope for our survival are Daniel Brooks, Professor Emeritus at the University of Toronto, and Salvador Augusta, Associate Professor at Virginia Commonwealth University and authors of the new book, Darwinian Survival Guide, Hope for the 21st Century. Daniel and Sal, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start off with reminding our listeners and Lynn and myself about Darwin's theory of evolution and survival.
One of the main things to know about Darwin's sort of panoramic view of the biosphere and the elements in it, the species that inhabit it, is that Darwin was primarily concerned with survival. He recognized that there were certain elements of conflict within the activities in the biosphere. Lions do eat zebras, for example, and cows do eat grass. But he was more concerned with survival and renewal, not so much with death and destruction. And he recognized that one of the things that happened when environmental conditions were stable or relatively the same for long periods of time was that during those periods of time, species tended to accumulate lots of variation. And that variation then became potential for coping with changes that would happen, that happened in the environment later. Now, the species have no idea what changes are coming. And so there's no guarantee that the accumulated new variants that show up during the good times will allow them to be successful with coping with unknown changes. But given the fact that Darwinian evolution has never failed in 4 billion years, it seems to have been a pretty effective mechanism.
So you two are both field biologists. How do you end up writing a book on the survivability prospects of the human race?
Yeah, I mean, we started off writing a book about evolutionary theory, because that's where our basic interests lie. And as field biologists, we have a strong connection to evolutionary theory. It's the foundation for all of biology. And in writing this book about evolutionary theory, we started to realize that for evolution to really be a theory that works for society, then we need to be able to make, you know, really explicit, direct connections between how evolutionary principles impact the way we look at applied issues like sustainability and conservation. So it really was an evolution of our thinking from the basic theory of evolution to thinking about what are the lessons that we can take from evolutionary theory about how humans should be possibly doing things better.
Yeah, a major thing that we found was we met for the first time when we were both working in a conservation area in Northwest Costa Rica in the early 2000s. Because we were out in the field in tropical environments a lot, we were seeing the impact of climate change on the local biodiversity, on the local ecosystems. But our perspective as field biologists was that we were most impressed by the fact that the biodiversity was coping with those changes. The biodiversity was not being destroyed. Things were not falling apart. Nothing was, you know, there was no big climate change apocalypse in those ecosystems, but there was a lot of change. And ultimately, the crossover from Darwin's fundamental message to humanity today is that evolutionary biologists teaches us that the way to cope successfully with changing conditions is to change, not to resist the change.
And to maintain the potential to change. In evolution, there is no such thing as deficit spending. You know, even though organisms are constantly exploiting their environments because of the way evolution works, because of the nature of inheritance, there's always a maintenance of potential to do something new if the conditions change. And so in thinking about that evolutionary principle and applying it to the way that humans interact with each other, with the biosphere or economic systems, you know, the message is pretty straightforward. If you spend everything all at once, or you grow the fastest all at once, or try to be the biggest all at once, you're not planning for the future.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with field biologists Daniel Brooks and Salvatore Augusta. They've written a new book called A Darwinian Survival Guide. Daniel, let me ask you this. You know, as field biologists and as you're talking about being up in northern Costa Rica and seeing how climate change has created change in the biosphere, in the species, and how those adaptations may or may not be occurring. What do you think has been so far our greatest departure from, you know, in terms of our interaction with the biosphere?
Yeah, that's interestingly enough, that demarcation comes about 15,000 years ago. You know, up until about 15,000 years ago, human beings were a very clever, very successful, widely distributed species that was behaving in accordance with Darwinian principles. When conditions were good, they stayed in place. When conditions changed and they could no longer stay there, they simply moved away and found better living conditions. But starting about 15,000 years ago, human beings embarked on what is now called the Anthropocene epoch or period or whatever you want to call it. But that's marked by the point at which human beings began to believe that they could control all of their surroundings, they could control the world for their own purposes. And that was marked initially by the emergence of what we call high production agriculture. So this is a period when human beings begin to produce more than they need and begin to attempt to control everything in their surroundings. And of course, you know, our attitude is so how's that working out? Doesn't look too good. So we sometimes say the biosphere has been around for 4 billion years. Human beings of some form or another have been around for 3 million years. Anthropocene humans, modern humans, have been around for 15,000 years and we're already in trouble. So clearly, from an evolutionary standpoint, what we're doing is not working. And the fact that we're a very clever species is probably explains why we've gotten as far as we have. But we think our luck's run out. And we're at a point where the amount of technological innovation it would take to try to overcome our attempts to alter biology is greater than the amount of time we have before events overtake us.
I'm wondering, Daniel, as a follow-up to that, how often you are talking to lay people out there at a party or something. And you mentioned the 15,000 years that we've been setting ourselves in this incorrect trajectory. And the way you explain it, comparing it to how long humans have been on the planet, you know, it does set the correct perspective. But how often do people say, hey, we've been surviving for 15,000 years doing what we're doing. We're going to figure it out. And then what do you say to that?
That's a really, really good question, because that's a very common reaction. That's sometimes also coupled with, well, my kids will figure it out and I'll be dead and I don't have to worry about it. Okay, so this is an expression of a fundamental aspect of human psychology, which is denial. What it really means when somebody says that to me, what they really mean is, we know there's a problem, we're afraid, we don't know what to do about it, so we don't want to talk about it. So we'll pretend that this is not true. So the idea that human beings have always coped with problems in the past quite successfully, this is not true. For example, one of the things that we're concerned about is the idea that urbanization, large crowded cities in climate insecure places, is a bad idea. Now, we're already seeing people realize that to a certain extent. But one of the things I tell people, say at social gatherings, is we would not have a discipline called archaeology if it were not for the fact that there are more abandoned cities on this planet than there are occupied cities on this planet. So you go back to this a little bit snarky question, which is, how is it working out? You know, what you're doing, what we say is business as usual, is not working. Inaction is not an option. So we need to try something else. And our suggestion is that since there's only one theory of survival that science has come up with, maybe we might want to apply that a little more directly to what's going on in the world.
Sal, in the book, one of the main premises of the book is to switch the conversation from sustainability to survival. So what does that actually mean for people? Because I think a lot of people will think, well, if I'm sustainable, aren't I just automatically surviving? Like Daniel just said, it's not working.
Well, this is the argument that we make, that to the extent that sustainability is the idea that we just need to figure out how we can do less of what we're doing, or do it more efficiently, or somehow do it more equitably. And by doing that, things are going to return to normal, whatever that means, and everything will be okay. I think what we're saying is we need to question that in the first place, because that's basically saying if we do business as usual a little better, then everything will be okay. However, if the fundamental problem is our behavior in the first place, then it brings into question, well, what set of behaviors are actually survivable before we start talking about what's sustainable? So, you know, what we're saying is, not that we need to not be talking about sustainability, but first we need to define what's survivable. Basically, we can't blow up the planet, right? And we can't have such an effect that it completely restricts the planet's ability to cope with change by changing. Those are the two main things. And then once, you know, we understand what's survivable, then we can start talking about what's sustainable.
In the book, you talk about how millions of years ago, hundreds of thousands of years ago, humans were more adaptable and changeable. But it's been in the last, let's say, even just the last 15,000 years, we've dug our feet in and we are not changing. What happened?
Well, I mean, again, and this goes back to what Dan was saying to build on that. But I think a really nice way to think about the problem that we use in the book is, if we think about human beings as being the quintessential central place foragers, right? This is what humans did about the landscape. They move into an area, use up resources, deplete those resources, and move on. Like beavers, right? We talk about beavers in the book. They're the classic central place forager. This is what beavers do. They move into an area, they engineer the ecosystem to their own benefit. They deplete resources. And from their perspective, you know, the environment is trashed and they move on. And this is what humans did. And so 15,000 years ago, when we decided to basically, you know, settle down and stay in place, we became sedentary, but we never abandoned our central place foraging activities. So for 15,000 years, we've essentially been central place foragers using up all the, you know, resources in an area without leaving. And so what evolved? You know, what evolved was an entire mentality, entire set of behaviors that are about, we're not abandoning this place. And if conditions change, then we're going to look to our neighbors to see what we can take from them, perpetual warfare, and or we're going to start thinking about what new technologies we can develop to save ourselves from, you know, from the worst outcomes of the change. And slowly but surely, we now live in a world where essentially, you know, the mentality is not that the climate's changing, so let's move, but the climate's changing, so let's stay.
So this all sounds pretty much, well, pretty dreadful, frankly. And yet, the tagline of your book is hope for the 21st century. So Sal, there is hope. Tell us where that hope comes from.
Well, the hope, again, comes from looking at it from a Darwinian perspective. Evolution tells us that, first of all, we don't have to be the best. We just need to be sufficient to survive. So there's hope that we actually can cope with the change that's coming. If we, again, recognize it, if we look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, we recognize that we actually have a lot of evolutionary potential to respond to climate change. If we were behaving more like, you know, the traditional evolutionary default of you cope with change by moving away, for example. So there's hope in the sense that these principles could guide us through climate change by being prepared to cope with what comes. Or if we don't and everything just collapses, then there's hope that these principles could be used to rebuild something more sustainable.
We have to recognize that we already have enough technology to take care of ourselves if we want to. What we don't have at the moment is a sustained will to change our behavior. Okay, so instead of using our technology to try to see which local society, which country can climb on top of everybody else and sustain themselves at the detriment of other people, instead of using the technology for that, if we use the technology to achieve as much as we can without hurting the welfare and the well-being of other people, in other words, hurting the well-being of other people is tantamount to reducing their evolutionary potential, which means we're decreasing our ability to learn from other people things that might help us survive. And so as a consequence, what we call this, or we use the term, this is not our term, but we say that the challenges facing humanity right now are what's called a no technological solution problem. In other words, technology is not going to save us. And that's okay, because in fact, we already have sufficient technology to take care of ourselves, to cope with these changes by changing. But the way we have to change involves changes in individual behavior.
I'm just going to add one last thing to the idea of hope. If you listen to the climate change rhetoric or dialogue or discussion, it's basically either we have to stop climate change right now, otherwise it's going to be total disaster. And that's, you know, or we're not going to do anything. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's sort of one of those two things, right? And basically what we're saying is that it's not just, we're not facing complete annihilation from climate change, and we actually don't need to stop or reverse it to cope with it. What we do need to understand is that it's coming, and we need to be prepared, and we're going to need to change our behavior. And there's a lot of hope in the sense that there is the potential to deal with climate change. The biosphere is not going to collapse. It's just that our technological world might, suffer immensely if we just ignore it, basically.
Mm-hmm. So, Sal, what would be an example of a behavior that you list out in your book that we can change, a behavior that we may not know about now, or that we know about but are too lazy to practice? Or maybe lazy is not the
yeah.
word.
I honestly think that question can be summed up with, you know, one answer, basically the concept of living within your means. Right? That's the fundamental behavior that if was more widespread on the planet, especially at an individual level, you know, in all the developed countries of the world, if the vast majority of people started taking on the personal mantra of living within your means, and you start making personal decisions based on that, and you start making decisions based on your family, and you start voting for people based on these principles, then, you know, I think that's the fundamental. And there's a lot of different behavioral details we can talk about, but living within our means is what we have not been doing for 15,000 years, essentially.
Well, one of the great things about this book, it's such a fascinating book on so many levels, but you guys actually present a solution. So many times books are like, here's all the problems, but you guys come up with, you present the four laws of biotics. Daniel, will you give us a summary if you can? And my first, and a follow-up question is that on the four laws, the first one is a zeroth law. Why did it not start at one?
Okay, well, The structure of this and the original inspiration for this came from Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy novels, the original trilogy. And he proposed, in parallel, he had a whole series of novels about robots. And these were early novels about AI. And he originally proposed what he called the three laws of robotics, 1, 2, and 3. 30 years later, He wrote some sequels to that, and he realized at that time that there was a more fundamental law than the three laws that he had proposed. And he saved himself by proposing the zeroth law in analogy with the laws of thermodynamics. Originally, there were three laws of thermodynamics, and then somebody realized, well, wait a minute, there's a much more fundamental thing. But by that time, everybody was teaching the first, second, and third laws of so. The physicist just said, we'll call this the zeroth law because it's more important than the other three. And so, and we talk about, we mentioned this in both of our books, where we got this inspiration. So the zeroth law of biotics is basically, you can't blow up the planet. In other words, you blow up the planet, then we've got nothing to talk about in terms of survival or sustainability or anything. So that's, in that sense, it's the... Before anything else, don't blow up the planet. Then you get into the next three laws. The first one of those is the fundamental idea about maintaining the maximum amount of evolutionary potential in the biosphere possible. Don't do things that limit the biosphere's potential. And then the next two, the final two, the second and third laws are about how humans can survive and be sustainable within the context of that. So that's where it came from. And they're, you know, these four laws are not, they're not like Newton's laws or anything. They're as we know from the Pirates of the Caribbean, these are more like suggestions than, these are guidelines. They're more like guidelines than actual laws. But it's an attempt to show that sustainability need discussions of how humans will sustain themselves have to be put in a context of basic survival. And that means coping with change by changing, not coping with change by resisting change or pretending silly things like we can stop climate change, we can reverse climate change. In a sense, that's what we've been trying to do for 15,000 years, and it's not working.
Let me ask one more question before we let you guys go. So much of the book, you talk about the myth of control that we humans think we have. How do we get past this idea that we actually have any control whatsoever?
Well, one way is that we learn the lesson the hard way and are shown that we actually don't have any control. I mean, the other way is education. The more people come from a background of understanding complex systems, understanding evolutionary systems, understanding that, you know, a complex system is by definition a dynamic system that constantly changes, you know, its feature is perpetual novelty, not staying the same, then that's a way maybe to get that point across.
Yeah, we need to let people know that we don't have to have absolute control in order to survive, be comfortable, be safe, have food, have water, have shelter, and have the benefits of what our technology has given us. The control is not the only way to survive. And ironically, the more we try to control in terms of trying to stop change, the more precarious our existence is going to be.
In fact, the way to be in control is to recognize, number one, that we're not in control, but to be in control in the sense of that we're anticipating and are comfortable with the fact that things are going to change and we're going to need to cope with that change. Yeah. You know, if that mentality, let's say, swept humanity versus what can we do to stop change? Change is bad. You know, that I think would go a long way also to making an impact.
Well, I think one thing our listeners all have control over is actually going and getting this book, because it is a fascinating, important book that I think everyone should read. Well, our guests today have been Daniel Brooks and Salvador Augusta. They are authors of A Darwinian Survival Guide, Hope for the 21st Century. Sal and Daniel, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. This is an important discussion that needs to keep going.
Thank you very much. It was very cool.
Support for KPCW comes from the Nature Conservancy. The Nature Conservancy's work extends through Utah and includes protecting the Great Salt Lake, which supports approximately 10 million birds every year and is vital to all life around the lake. A healthy lake is also essential for creating the greatest snow on Earth. Learn more at nature.org/Utah.
Thanks to our underwriters, IT Innovated and San Francisco Design. Hey, we've got just a minute here, so we thought we'd look at some of those interviews over the last year that we've really enjoyed. People ask us in the grocery store, the post office, what our favorite interview has been. And I usually say, oh, it was the last one, because they're really all so interesting. So here are a few things. The hazards of decaying space junk. That was from March 14th with Sierra Solter. As satellites and other orbital objects decay and burn up in the atmosphere, they're leaving a layer of conductive, electrically charged particles around the planet. This could have a dangerous effect on the Earth's ionosphere and life as we know it, aside from the space junk that it creates. And here's one from Lauren Young of Scientific American, and she writes about Ozempic and the GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic. I think it's a really great article that boils it down to what food noise is and how GLP-1 drugs get rid of that. Very interesting. That was from September 19th. As always, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio or on the web at kpcw.org. Under the Shows tab and Cool Science Radio, you can find all of our archived shows there. And as we wrap up this year, 2024, thank you for your support and for listening over the year. We really enjoy being able to share our curiosity for and our love of science and technology with you, our listeners. This coming year, we'll bring you stories about interviews, about the latest missions in space, keep an eye on AI and machine learning developments, and controversies, and the latest in human development, to name a few of the many topics we'll explore in 2025. Thank you for listening, and have a happy new year.